or at least to consider the feelings and beliefs of the rest of the world, and then to consider their unfortunate action in that light. And what about the trade issues? This one came from ABC. If China wants normalized trade relations with the United States, then China will have to open its markets to us. As you know, we have a law on the books here called the Trade Reform Act. That law allows us to mirror image other countries' trade laws and practices, so that whatever tactics are used against us, we can then use those very same tactics with respect to trade with them. Tomorrow I will direct the Department of State and the Department of Commerce to set up a working group to implement TRA with respect to the People's Republic, President Ryan announced, making the story for the day. And a bombshell it was. Christ, Jack, the Secretary of the Treasury said in his office across the street. He was getting a live feed from the Oval Office. He lifted his desk phone and punched a button. I want a read of the PRC's current cash accounts global, he told one of his subordinates from New York. Then his phone rang. Secretary of State on three, his secretary told him over the intercom. Sectrez grunted and picked up the phone. Yeah, I saw it too, Scott. So, Yuri Andreevich, how'd it go? Clark asked. It had taken over a week to set up, and mainly because General Kirillin had spent a few hours on the pistol range working on his technique. Now he'd just stormed into the officers' club bar, looking as though he'd taken one in the guts. Is he a mafia assassin? Chavez had himself a good laugh at that. General, he came to us because the Italian police wanted to get him away from the mafia. He got in the way of a mob assassination, and the local chieftain made noises about going after him and his family. What did he get you for? 50 euros, Kirillin nearly spat. You were confident going in, eh? Clark asked. Been there, done that. Got the fucking T-shirt, Ding finished the statement with a laugh. And 50 euros was a dent even in the salary of a Russian three-star. 3 points in a 500-point match. I scored 493. Ettore only got 496? Clark asked. Jesus, the boy's slowing down. He slid a glass in front of the Russian general officer. He's drinking more over here, Chavez observed. That must be it, Clark nodded. The Russian general officer was not, however, the least bit amused. Falcone is not human, Kirillin said, gunning down his first shot of vodka. He could scare Wild Bill Hickok, and that's a fact. And you know the worst part about it? What is that, Ivan Sergeyevich? He's so goddamned humble about it, like it's fucking normal to shoot like that. Jesus, Sam Snead was never that good with a five-iron. General, Domingo said after his second vodka of the evening, the problem with being in Russia was that you tended to pick up the local customs, and one of those was drinking. Every man on my team is an expert shot, and by expert I mean close to being on his country's Olympic team, okay? Big Bird's got us all beat, and none of us are used to losing any more than you are. But I'll tell you, I'm goddamn glad he's on my team. Just then Falcone walked through the door. Hey, Ettore, come on over. He hadn't gotten any shorter. Ettore towered over the diminutive Chavez, and still looked like a figure from an El Greco painting. General, he said in greeting to Kirillin, you shoot extremely well. Not so good as you, Falcone, the Russian responded. The Italian cop shrugged. I had a lucky day. Sure, guy, Clark reacted, as he handed Falcone a shot glass. I've come to like this vodka, Falcone said on gunning it down, but it affects my aim somewhat. Yeah, Ettore, Chavez chuckled. The general told us you blew 4 points in the match. You mean you have done better than this? Kirillin demanded. He has, Clark answered. I watched him shoot a possible 3 weeks ago. That was 500 points, too. That was a good day, Falcone agreed. I had a good night's sleep beforehand, and no hangover at all. Clark had himself a good chuckle and turned to look around the room. Just then another uniform entered the room and looked around. He spotted General Karelin and walked over. "Damn, who's this recruiting poster?" Ding wondered aloud as he approached.
"Tovarish General," the man said by way of greeting.
"Anatoly Ivanich," Karelin responded. "How are things at the center?"
Then the guy turned.
"You are John Clark?"
"That's me," the American confirmed. "Who are you?"
"Oh, this is Major Anatoly Shalepin," General Karelin answered. "He's chief of personal security for Sergei Golovko."
"We know your boss." Ding held out his hand.
"Howdy. I'm Domingo Chavez."
Handshakes were exchanged all around.
"Could we speak in a quieter place?" Shalepin asked.
The four men took over a corner booth in the club. Falcone remained at the bar.
"Sergei Nikolaevich sent you over?" the Russian general asked.
"You haven't heard," Major Shalepin answered.
It was the way he said it that got everyone's attention. He spoke in Russian, which Clark and Chavez understood well enough.
"I want my people to train with you."
"Haven't heard what?" Karelin asked.
"We found out who tried to kill the chairman," Shalepin answered.
"Oh, he was the target? I thought they were after the pimp," Karelin objected.
"You guys want to tell us what you're talking about?" Clark asked.
"A few weeks ago there was an assassination attempt in Dzerzhinsky Square," Shalepin responded, explaining what they'd thought at the time. "But now it appears they hit the wrong target."
"Somebody tried to waste Golovko?" Domingo asked. "Damn."
"Who was it?"
"The man who arranged it was a former KGB officer named Suvorov, so we believe, that is. He used two ex-Spetsnaz soldiers. They have both been murdered, probably to conceal their involvement, or at least to prevent them from discussing it with anyone."
Shalepin didn't add anything else.
"In any case, we have heard good things about your rainbow troops, and we want you to help train my protective detail."
"It's okay with me, so long as it's okay with Washington."
Clark stared hard into the bodyguard's eyes. He looked damn serious, but not very happy with the world at the moment.
"We will make the formal request tomorrow."
"They are excellent, these rainbow people," Karelin assured him. "We are getting along well with them. Anatoly used to work for me back when I was a colonel."
The tone of voice told what he thought of the younger man. There was more to this, Clark thought. A senior Russian official didn't just ask a former CIA officer for help with something related to his personal safety out of the clear blue. He caught Ding's eye and saw the same thought. Suddenly, both were back in the spook business.
"Okay," John said. "I'll call home tonight if you want."
He'd do that from the American Embassy, probably on the Stew 6 in the station chief's office.
Chapter 37 Fallout.
The VC-137 landed without fanfare at Andrews Air Force Base. The base lacked a proper terminal and the attendant jetways, and so the passengers debarked on stairs grafted onto a flatbed truck. Cars waited at the bottom to take them into Washington. Mark Gant was met by two Secret Service agents who drove him at once to the Treasury Department building across the street from the White House. He'd barely gotten used to being on the ground when he found himself in the Secretary's office.
"How'd it go?" George Winston asked.
"Interesting, to say the least," Gant said, his mind trying to get used to the fact that his body didn't have a clue where it was at the moment. "I thought I'd be going home to sleep it off."
"Ryan's invoking the Trade Recovery Act against the Chinese."
"Oh. Well, that's not all that much of a surprise, is it?"
"Look at this," Sectrez commanded, handing over a recently produced printout.
This was a report on the current cash holdings of the People's Republic of China.
How solid is this information? Telescope asked Trader.
The report was an intelligence estimate in all but name. Employees within the Treasury Department routinely kept track of international monetary transactions as a means of determining the day-to-day strength of the dollar and other internationally traded currencies. That included the Chinese yuan, which had been having a slightly bad time of late.
"They're this thin?" Gant asked.
"I thought they were running short of cash, but I didn't know it was quite this bad."
"It surprised me, too," Sectrez admitted.
"It appears that they've been purchasing a lot of things on the international market lately, especially jet engines from France, and because they're late paying for the last round, the French company has decided to take a harder line. They're the only game in town. We won't let GE or Pratt & Whitney bid on the order, and the Brits have similarly forbidden Rolls-Royce. That makes the French the sole source. Which isn't so bad for the French, is it? They've jacked up the price about 15%, and they're asking for cash up front."
"The yuan's going to take a hit," Gant predicted.
"They've been trying to cover this up, eh?"
"Yeah, and fairly successfully."
"That's why they were hitting us so hard on the trade deal. They saw this one coming, and they wanted a favorable announcement to bail them out. But they sure didn't play it very smart. Damn, you have this sort of a problem, you learn to crawl a little."
"I thought so, too.
Why do you think?"
"They're proud, George. Very, very proud. Like a rich family that's lost its money but not its social position, and tries to make up for the one with the other. But it doesn't work. Sooner or later, people find out that you're not paying your bills, and then the whole world comes crashing in on you. You can put it off for a while, which makes sense if you have something coming in. But if the ship don't dock, you sink."
Gant flipped some pages, thinking, "The other problem is that countries are run by politicians, people with no real understanding of money, who figure they can always maneuver their way out of whatever comes up. They're so used to having their own way that they never really think they can't have it that way all the time." One of the things Gant had learned working in D.C. was that politics was just as much about illusion as the motion picture business was, which perhaps explained the affinity the two communities had for each other. But even in Hollywood you had to pay the bills, and you had to show a profit. Politicians always had the option of using T-bills to finance their accounts, and they also printed the money. Nobody expected the government to show a profit, and the board of directors was the voters, the people whom politicians conned as a way of life. It was all crazy, but that was the political game.
"That's probably what the PRC leaders were thinking," Gant surmised.
But sooner or later, reality raised its ugly head. And when it did, all the time spent trying to avoid it was what really bit you on the ass. That was when the whole world said, "Gotcha." And then you were well and truly got. In this case, the gotcha could be the collapse of the Chinese economy. And it would happen virtually overnight.
"George, I think State and CIA need to see this, and the President, too."
"Lord." The President was sitting in the Oval Office, smoking one of Ellen Sumter's Virginia Slims and watching TV. This time it was C-SPAN. Members of the United States House of Representatives were speaking in the well about China. The content of the speeches was not complimentary, and the tone was decidedly inflammatory. All were speaking in favor of a resolution to condemn the People's Republic of China. C-SPAN, too, was covering much the same verbiage in the Senate. Though the language was a touch milder, the import of the words was not. Labor unions were united with churches, liberals with conservatives, even free traders with protectionists. More to the point, CNN and the other networks showed demonstrations in the streets, and it appeared that Taiwan's "We're the Good Guys" campaign had taken hold. Somebody, nobody was sure who yet, had even printed up stickers of the red Chinese flag with the caption, "We kill babies and ministers." They were being attached to products imported from China. And the protesters were also busy identifying the American firms that did a lot of business on the Chinese mainland, with the aim of boycotting them.
Ryan's head turned.
Talk to me, Arnie.
This looks serious, Jack, Van Dam said.
Gee, Arnie, I can see that.
How serious?
Enough that I'd sell stock in those companies. They're going to take a hit, and this movement may have legs.
What?
I mean, it might not go away real soon. Next, you're going to see posters with stills from the TV coverage of those two clerics being murdered. That's an image that doesn't go away. If there's any product the Chinese sell here that we can get elsewhere, then a lot of Americans will start buying it elsewhere.
The picture on CNN changed to live coverage of a demonstration outside the PRC embassy in Washington. The signs said things like, "Murderers, killers, and barbarians."
I wonder if Taiwan is helping to organize this.
Probably not. At least not yet, Van Dam thought.
If I were they, I wouldn't exactly mind, but I wouldn't need to play with this.
They'll probably increase their efforts to distinguish themselves from the mainland, and that amounts to the same thing. Look for the networks to do stories about the Republic of China, and how upset they are with all this crap in Beijing. How they don't want to be tarred with the same brush and all that, the chief of staff said.
You know, yes, we are Chinese, but we believe in human rights and freedom of religion. That sort of thing.
It's the smart move. They have some good PR advisors here in D.C.
Hell, I probably know some of them. And if I were on the payroll, that's what I would advise.
That's when the phone rang. It was Ryan's private line, the one that usually bypassed the secretaries. Jack lifted it.
Yeah?
Jack, it's George across the street. Got a minute? I want to show you something, buddy.
Sure, come on over.
Jack hung up and turned to Arnie.
Sec Trez, he explained, says it's important.
The president paused.
Arnie?
Yeah?
How much maneuvering room do I have with this?
The Chinese? Arnie asked, getting a nod.
Not a hell of a lot, Jack. Sometimes the people themselves decide what our policy is.
And the people will be making policy now by voting with their pocketbooks. Next, we'll see some companies announce that they're suspending their commercial contracts with the PRC. The Chinese already fucked Boeing over, and in the full light of day, which wasn't real smart. Now the people out there will want to fuck them back. You know, there are times when the average Joe citizen stands up on his hind feet and gives the world a finger. When that happens, it's your job mainly to follow them, not to lead them, the chief of staff concluded.
His Secret Service code name was Carpenter, and he'd just constructed a box for his president to stay inside.
Jack nodded and stubbed out the smoke.
He might be the most powerful man in the world, but his power came from the people, and as it was theirs to give, it was also sometimes theirs to exercise. Few people could simply open the door to the Oval Office and walk in. But George Winston was one of them, mainly because the Secret Service belonged to him. Mark Gant was with him, looking as though he'd just run a marathon chased by a dozen armed and angry Marines in jeeps.
"Hey, Jack."
"George."
"Mark, you look like hell," Ryan said.
"Oh, you just flew in, didn't you?"
"Is this Washington or Shanghai?" Gant offered, as rather a wan joke.
"We took the tunnel. Jesus, have you seen the demonstrators outside?"
"I think they want you to nuke Beijing," Sec Trez observed.
The president just pointed at his bank of television sets by way of an answer.
"Hell, why are they demonstrating here? I'm on their side. At least I think I am.
Anyway, what brings you over?"
"Check this out." Winston nodded to Gant.
"Mr. President, these are the PRC's current currency accounts. We keep tabs on currency trading worldwide to make sure we know where the dollar is, which means we pretty much know where all the hard currency is in the world."
"Okay."
Ryan knew about that, sort of. He didn't worry much about it since the dollar was in pretty good shape, and the non-squeaky wheel didn't need any grease.
"So?"
"So the PRC's liquidity situation is in the shitter," Gant reported. "Maybe that's why they were so pushy in the trade talks. If so, they picked the wrong way to approach us. They demanded instead of asked."
Ryan looked down the columns of numbers.
Damn, where have they been dumping all their money?
Buying military hardware. France and Russia, mostly, but a lot went to Israel, too. It was not widely known that the PRC had spent a considerable sum of money in Israel, mainly paid to IDI, Israel Defense Industries, to buy American-designed hardware manufactured under license in Israel. It was stuff the Chinese could not purchase directly from America, including guns for their tanks and air-to-air missiles for their fighter aircraft. America had winked at the transactions for years. In conducting this business, Israel had turned its back on Taiwan, despite the fact that both countries had produced their nuclear weapons as a joint venture, back when they'd stuck together, along with South Africa, as international pariahs with no other friends in that particular area. In polite company, it was called Realpolitik. In other areas of human activity, it was called Fuck Your Buddy.
And? Ryan asked.
And they've spent their entire trade surplus this way, Gant reported. All of it, mainly on short-term purchase items, but some long-term as well. And for the long-term stuff, they had to pay cash up front because of the nature of the transactions. The producers need the cash to run the production, and they don't want to get stuck holding the bag. Not too many people need 5,000 tank guns, Gant explained. The market is kinda exclusive.
So?
So China is essentially out of cash. And they have real short-term cash needs, like oil, Telescope went on. China's a net importer of oil. Production in their domestic fields falls well short, even though their needs are not really that great. Not too many Chinese citizens own cars. They have enough cash for 3 months' worth of oil, and then they come up short. The international oil market demands prompt payment. They can skate for a month, maybe 6 weeks. But after that, the tankers will turn around in mid-ocean and go somewhere else. They can do that, you know. And then the PRC runs out. It'll be like running into a wall, sir. Smack. No more oil. And then their country starts coming to a stop, including their military, which is their largest oil consumer. They've been running unusually high for some years because of increased activity in their maneuvers and training and stuff. They probably have strategic reserves, but we don't know exactly how much. And that can run out, too. We've been expecting them to make a move on the Spratly Islands. There's oil there, and they've been making noises about it off and on for about 10 years. But the Philippines and other countries in the area have made claims, too. And they probably expect us to side with the Philippines for historical reasons. Not to mention, Seventh Fleet is still the biggest kid on the block in that part of the world.
Yeah. Ryan nodded.
If it came to a showdown, the Philippines appear to have the best claim on the islands, and we would back them up. We've shed blood together in the past, and that counts.
Go on.
So, John Chinaman is short of oil, and he may not have the cash to pay for it, especially if our trade with them goes down the toilet. They need our dollars. The yuan isn't very strong anyway. International trading is also done in dollars. And as I just told you, sir, they've spent most of them.
What are you telling me?
Sir, the PRC is just about bankrupt. In a month or so, they're going to find that out, and it's going to be a bit of a shock for them.
When did we find this out?
Oh, that's my doing, Jack, the Secretary of the Treasury said. I called up these documents earlier today, and then I had Mark go over them. He's our best man for economic modeling, even whacked out with jet lag.
So we can squeeze them on this?
Well, that's one option.
What if these demonstrations take hold?
Gant and Winston shrugged simultaneously.
That's where psychology enters into the equation, said Winston.
We can predict it to some extent on Wall Street. That's how I made most of my money. But psychoanalyzing a country is beyond my ken. That's your job, pal. I just run your accounting office across the street.
I need more than that, George.
Another shrug. If the average citizen boycotts Chinese goods, and or if American companies who do business over there start trimming their sales...
That's damned likely, Gant interjected. This has got to have a lot of CEOs shitting their pants.
Well, if that happens, the Chinese get one in the guts,
and it's going to hurt big time, Trader concluded.
And how will they react to that, Ryan wondered.
He punched his phone button.
Ellen, I need one.
His secretary appeared in a flash and handed him a cigarette. Ryan lit it and thanked her with a smile and a nod.
Have you talked this one over with State yet?
A shake of the head.
No, wanted to show it to you first.
Mark, what did you make of the negotiations?
They're the most arrogant sons of bitches I've ever seen. I mean, I've met all sorts of big shots in my time, movers and shakers. But even the worst of them know when they need my money to do business, and when they know that, their manners get better. When you shoot a gun, you try to make sure you don't have it aimed at your own dick.
That made Ryan laugh, while Arnie cringed.
You weren't supposed to talk that way to the President of the United States. But some of these people knew that you could talk that way to John Patrick Ryan, the man.
By the way, along those lines, I liked what you told that Chinese diplomat.
What's that, sir?
Their dicks aren't big enough to get in a pissing contest with us. Nice turn of phrase, if not exactly diplomatic.
How did you know that? Gant asked, the surprise showing on his face.
I never repeated that to anybody, not even to that jerk Rutledge.
Oh, we have ways, Jack answered, suddenly realizing that he'd revealed something from a compartment named Zorga.
Oops.
Sounds like something you say at the New York Athletic Club, Sectrez observed. But only if you're 4 feet or so away from the guy.
But it appears it's true, at least in monetary terms.
So, we have a gun we can point at their heads?
Yes, sir, we sure do, Gant answered.
It might take them a month to figure it out, but they won't be able to run away from it for very long.
Okay, make sure State and the agency find this out.
And, oh, tell CIA that they're supposed to get this stuff to me first. Intelligence estimates are their job.
They have an economics unit, but they're not all that good, Gant told the others.
No surprise. The smart people in this area work the street, or maybe academia. You can make more money at Harvard Business School than you can in government service.
And talent goes where the money is, Jack agreed.
Junior partners at medium-sized law firms made more than the president, which sometimes explained the sort of people who ended up here. Public service was supposed to be a sacrifice.
It was for him. Ryan had proven his ability to make money in the trading business. But for him, service to his country had been learned from his father, and at Quantico, long before he'd been seduced into the Central Intelligence Agency, and then later tricked into the Oval Office. And once here, you couldn't run away from it. At least, not and keep your manhood. That was always the trap. Robert Edward Lee had called duty the most sublime of words. And he would have known, Ryan thought. Lee had felt himself trapped into fighting for what was at best a soiled cause, because of his perceived duty to his place of birth. And therefore many would curse his name for all eternity, despite his qualities as a man and a soldier.
So, Jack, he asked himself, in your case, where do talent and duty and right and wrong and all that other stuff lie? What the hell are you supposed to do now?
He was supposed to know. All those people outside the White House's campus-like grounds expected him to know all the time where the right thing was. Right for the country. Right for the world. Right for every working man, woman, and innocent little kid playing t-ball.
Yeah, the president thought. Sure.
You're anointed by the wisdom fairy when you walk in here every day, or kissed on the ear by the muse. Or maybe Washington and Lincoln whisper to you in your dreams at night. He sometimes had trouble picking his tie in the morning, especially if Kathy wasn't around to be his fashion advisor. But he was supposed to know what to do with taxes, defense, and Social Security.
Why?
Because it was his job to know. Because he happened to live in government housing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and had the secret goddamn service protect him everywhere he went. At the basic school at Quantico, the officers instructing newly commissioned Marine second lieutenants had told them about the loneliness of command.
The difference between that and what he had here was like the difference between a fucking firecracker and a nuclear weapon. This kind of situation had started wars in the past. That wouldn't happen now, of course, but it had once. It was a sobering thought. Ryan took a last puff on his fifth smoke of the day and killed it in the brown glass ashtray he kept hidden in a desk drawer. "Thanks for bringing me this. Talk it over with State and CIA," he told them again. "I want a snee on this, and I want it soon." "Right," George Winston said, standing for the underground walk back to his building across the street. "Mr. Gant," Jack added, "get some sleep. You look like hell." "I'm allowed to sleep in this job?" Telescope asked. "Sure you are, just like I am," POTUS told him with a lopsided smile. When they left, he looked at Arnie. "Talk to me. Speak to Adler and have him talk to Hitch and Rutledge, which you ought to do too," Arnie advised. Ryan nodded. "Okay, tell Scott what I need and that I need it fast." "Good news," Professor North told her as she came back into the room. Andrea Price O'Day was in Baltimore, at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, seeing Dr. Madge North, professor of obstetrics and gynecology. "Really?" "Really," Dr. North assured her with a smile. "You're pregnant." Before anything else could happen, Inspector Patrick O'Day leapt to his feet and lifted his wife in his arms for a powerful kiss and a rib-cracking hug. "Oh," Andrea said almost to herself, "I thought I was too old." "The record is well into the 50s, and you're well short of that," Dr. North said, smiling. It was the first time in her professional career that she'd given this news to two people carrying guns. "Any problems?" Pat asked. "Well, Andrea, you are prime ep. You're over 40, and this is your first pregnancy, isn't it?" "Yes." She knew what was coming, but she didn't invite it by speaking the word. "That means that there is an increased likelihood of Down syndrome. We can establish that with an amniocentesis. I'd recommend we do that soon." "How soon?" "I can do it today if you wish." "And if the test is positive, well, then you two have to decide if you want to bring a Down's child into the world. Some people do, but others don't. It's your decision to make, not mine," Madge North told them. She'd done abortions in her career, but like most obstetricians, she much preferred to deliver babies. "Downs, how and, I mean," Andrea said, squeezing her husband's hand. "Look, the odds are very much in your favor, like 100 to 1 or so, and those are betting odds. Before you worry about it, the smart thing is to find out if there's anything to worry about at all, okay?" "Right now?" Pat asked for his wife. Dr. North stood. "Yes, I have the time right now." "Why don't you take a little walk, Pat?" Special Agent Price O'Day suggested to her husband. She managed to keep her dignity intact, which didn't surprise her husband. "Okay, honey." A kiss, and he watched her leave. It was not a good moment for the career FBI agent. His wife was pregnant, but now he had to wonder if the pregnancy was a good one or not. If not, then what? He was an Irish Catholic, and his church forbade abortion as murder, and murders were things he'd investigated, and even witnessed once. 10 minutes later, he'd killed the two terrorists responsible for it. That day still came back to him in perverse dreams, despite the heroism he'd displayed and the kudos he'd received for all of it. But now he was afraid. Andrea had been a fine stepmother for his little Megan, and both he and she wanted nothing in all the world more than this news, if it was really good news. It would probably take an hour, and he knew he couldn't spend it sitting down in a doctor's outer office full of pregnant women reading old copies of People and U.S. Weekly. But where to go? Whom to see? Okay. He stood and walked out, and decided to head over to the Momini building.
It ought not be too hard to find, and it wasn't. Roy Altman was the telltale. The big former paratrooper who headed the surgeon detail didn't stand in one place like a potted plant, but rather circulated around, not unlike a lion in a medium-sized cage, always checking, looking with highly trained and experienced eyes for something that wasn't quite right. He spotted O'Day in the elevator lobby and waved.
"Hey, Pat, what's happening?"
All the rivalry between the FBI and the USSS stopped well short of this point. O'Day had saved the life of Sandbox and avenged the deaths of three of Altman's fellow agents, including Roy's old friend, Don Russell, who'd died like a man, gun in hand and three dead assassins in front of him. O'Day had finished Don's work. "My wife's over being checked out," the FBI inspector answered.
"Nothing serious?" Altman asked.
"Routine," Pat responded. And Altman caught the scent of a lie, but not an important one.
"Is she around? While I'm here, I thought I'd stop over and say hi."
"In her office," Altman waved. "Straight down, second on the right."
"Thanks."
"Bureau guy coming back to see surgeon," he said into his lapel mic.
"Roger,"
another agent responded. O'Day found the office door and knocked.
"Come in," the female voice inside said. Then she looked up.
"Oh, Pat, how are you?"
"No complaints. Just happened to be in the neighborhood and—"
"Did Andrea see Madge?" Kathy Ryan asked.
Flotus had helped make the appointment, of course.
"Yeah, and the little box doodad has a plus sign in it," Pat reported.
"Great."
Then Professor Ryan paused.
"Oh, you're worried about something."
In addition to being an eye doctor, she knew trouble when she saw it. "Dr. North is doing an amniocentesis. Any idea how long it takes?"
"When did it start?"
"Right about now, I think." Kathy knew the problem.
"Give it an hour. Madge is very good and very careful in her procedures. They tap into the uterus and withdraw some of the amniotic fluid. That will give them some of the tissue from the embryo, and then they examine the chromosomes. She'll have the lab people standing by. Madge is senior staff, and when she talks, people listen."
"She seems pretty competent."
"She's a wonderful doc. She's my OB.
You're worried about Downs, right?"
A nod.
"Yep."
"Nothing you can do but wait."
"Dr. Ryan, I'm—"
"My name's Kathy, Pat. We're friends, remember?"
There was nothing like saving the life of a woman's child to get on her permanent good side.
"Okay, Kathy.
Yeah, I'm scared. It's not... I mean, Andrea's a cop, too, but...
But being good with a gun or just being tough doesn't help much right now, does it?"
"Not worth a damn," Inspector O'Day confirmed quietly.
He was about as used to being frightened as he was of flying the space shuttle. But potential danger to his wife and or kid, kids now maybe, the kind of danger in which he was utterly helpless, well, that was one of the buttons a capricious fate could push while she laughed.
"The odds are way in your favor," Kathy told him.
"Yeah, Dr. North said so, but—"
"Yeah, and Andrea is younger than I am."
O'Day looked down at the floor, feeling like a total fucking wimp. More than once in his life he'd faced down armed men, criminals with violent pasts, and intimidated them into surrender. Once in his life he'd had to use his Smith & Wesson 1076 automatic in anger, and both times he'd double-tapped the heads of the terrorists, sending them off to Allah, so they'd probably believed, to answer for the murder of the innocent woman. It hadn't been easy exactly, but neither had it been all that hard. The endless hours of practice had made it nearly as routine as the working of his service automatic. But this wasn't danger to himself. He could deal with that. The worst danger, he was just learning, was to those you loved.
"Pat, it's okay to be scared. John Wayne was just an actor, remember?" But that was it. The code of manhood to which most Americans subscribed was that of the Duke, and that code did not allow fear. In truth, it was about as realistic as Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But, foolish or not, there it was. I'm not used to it. Kathy Ryan understood. Most doctors did. When she'd been a straight ophthalmic surgeon, before specializing in lasers, she'd seen the patients and the patients' families. The former in pain, but trying to be brave. The latter just scared. You tried to repair the problems of one and assuage the fears of the other. Neither task was easy. The one was just skill and professionalism. The other involved showing them that, although this was a horrid emergency, which they'd never experienced before, for Kathy Ryan, M.D., F.A.C.S., it was just another day at the office. She was the pro from Dover. She could handle it. Surgeon was blessed with the demeanor that inspired confidence in all she met. But even that didn't apply here. Though Madge North was a gifted physician, she was testing for a predetermined condition. Maybe someday it could be fixed. Genetic therapy offered that hope, 10 years or so down the line. But not today. Madge could merely determine what already was. Madge had great hands and a good eye, but the rest of it was in God's hands, and God had already decided one way or the other. It was just a matter of finding out what his decision had been. "This is when a smoke comes in handy," the inspector observed, with a grimacing smirk. "You smoke?" He shook his head. "I gave it up a long time ago." "You should tell Jack." The FBI agent looked up. "I didn't know he smokes." "He bums them off his secretary every so often, the wimp," Kathy told the FBI agent, with almost a laugh. "I'm not supposed to know." "That's very tolerant for a doc." "His life's hard enough, and it's only a couple a day. And he doesn't do it around the kids, or Andrea'd have to shoot me for ripping his face off." "You know," O'Day said, looking down again and speaking from the cowboy boots he liked to wear under his blue FBI suit, "if it comes back that it's a Downs kid, what the hell do we do then?" "That's not an easy choice." "Hell, under the law, I don't get a choice. I don't even have a say in it, do I?" "No, you don't." Kathy didn't venture that this was an inequity. The law was firm on the point. The woman, in this case the wife, alone could choose to continue the pregnancy or terminate it. Kathy knew her husband's views on abortion. Her own views were not quite identical, but she did regard that choice as distasteful. "Pat, why are you borrowing trouble?" "It's not under my control." Like most men, Kathy saw, Pat O'Day was a control freak. She could understand that, because so was she. It came from using instruments to change the world to suit her wishes. But this was an extreme case. This tough guy was deeply frightened. He really ought not to be, but it was a question of the unknown for him. She knew the odds, and they were actually pretty good. But he was not a doctor, and all men, even the tough ones, she saw, feared the unknown. Well, it wasn't the first time she'd babysat an adult who needed his hand held. And this one had saved Katie's life. "Want to walk over to the daycare center?" "Sure." O'Day stood. It wasn't much of a walk, and her intention was to remind O'Day what this was all about. Getting a new life into the world. "Surgeon's on the way to the playpen," Roy Altman told his detail. Kyle Daniel Ryan, Sprite, was sitting up now, and playing very simply with very rudimentary toys under the watchful eyes of the lionesses, as Altman thought of them, four young female Secret Service agents who fawned over Sprite like big sisters. But these sisters all carried guns, and they all remembered what had nearly happened to Sandbox.
A nuclear weapons storage site was hardly as well guarded as this particular daycare center. Outside the playroom was Trenton Chip Kelly, the only male agent on the detail, a former Marine captain who would have frightened the average NFL lineman with a mere look.
Hey, Chip.
Hi, Roy. What's happening?
Just strolling over to see the little guy.
Who's the muscle?
Kelly saw that O'Day was carrying heat, but decided he looked like a cop. But his left thumb was still on the button of his crash alarm, and his right hand was within a third of a second of his service automatic.
Bureau. He's cool, Altman assured his subordinate.
Okay.
Kelly opened the door.
Who'd he play for? O'Day asked Altman, once inside.
The Bears drafted him, but he scared Ditka too much.
Altman laughed. Ex-Marine.
I believe it.
Then O'Day walked up behind Dr. Ryan. She'd already scooped Kyle up, and his arms were around her neck. The little boy was babbling, still months away from talking, but he knew how to smile when he saw his mommy.
"Want to hold him?" Kathy asked.
O'Day cradled the infant somewhat like a football. The youngest Ryan examined his face dubiously, especially the Zapata mustache, but mommy's face was also in sight, and so he didn't scream.
"Hey, buddy," O'Day said gently.
Some things came automatically. When holding a baby, you don't stand still. You move a little bit, rhythmically, which the little one seemed to like.
"It'll ruin Andrea's career," Kathy said.
"Make a lot better hours for her, and be nice to see her every night, but..." "Yeah, Kathy, be kind of hard for her to run alongside the car with her belly sticking out 2 feet." The image was good enough for a laugh.
"I suppose they'll put her on restricted duty."
"Maybe. Makes for a great disguise, though, doesn't it?"
O'Day nodded.
This wasn't so bad, holding a kid. He remembered the old Irish adage, "True strength lies in gentleness." But what the hell, taking care of kids was also a man's duty. There was a lot more to being a man than just having a dick. Kathy saw the display and had to smile. Pat O'Day had saved Katie's life and done it like something out of a John Woo movie, except that Pat was a real tough guy, not the movie kind. His scenes weren't scripted. He'd had to do it for real, making it up as he'd gone along. He was a lot like her husband, a servant of the law, a man who'd sworn an oath to do the right thing every time. And, like her husband, clearly a man who took his oath seriously. One of those oaths concerned Pat's relationship with Andrea. And they all came down to the same thing. Preserve, protect, defend. And now this tiger with a tie was holding a baby and smiling and swaying back and forth, because that's what you did with a baby in your arms.
"How's your daughter?" Kathy asked.
"She and your Katie are good friends. And she's got a thing going with one of the boys at Giant Steps."
"Oh?"
"Jason Hunt.
I think it's serious. He gave Megan one of his Hot Wheels cars."
O'Day laughed. "That's when his cell phone went off." "Right side coat pocket," he told the First Lady. Kathy fished in his pocket and pulled it out. She flipped it open.
"Hello?"
"Who's this?" a familiar voice asked.
"Andrea, it's Kathy. Pat's right here."
Kathy took Kyle and handed off the phone, watching the FBI agent's face.
"Yeah, honey?"
Pat said.
Then he listened, and his eyes closed for 2 or 3 seconds, and that told the tale.
His tense face relaxed. A long breath came out slowly, and the shoulders no longer looked like a man anticipating a heavy blow.
"Yeah, baby, I came over to see Dr. Ryan, and we're in the nursery."
"Oh, okay." Pat looked over and handed over the phone. Kathy cradled it between her shoulder and ear.
"So what did Madge say?" Kathy asked, already knowing most of it.
Normal. And it's going to be a boy.
So Madge was right. The odds were in your favor.
And they still were.
Andrea was very fit. She wouldn't have any problems, Kathy was sure.
7 months from next Tuesday, Andrea said, her voice already bubbling.
Well, listen to what Madge says. I do, Kathy assured her. She knew all the stuff Dr. North believed in. Don't smoke, don't drink, do your exercises, take the classes on prepared delivery along with your husband. Come see me in 5 weeks for your next checkup. Read what to expect when you're expecting. Kathy handed the phone back. Inspector O'Day had taken a few steps and turned away. When he turned back to take the phone, his eyes were unusually moist.
Yeah, honey, okay, I'll be right over.
He killed the phone and dumped it back in his pocket.
Feel better? She asked with a smile.
One of the lionesses came over to take Kyle back. The little guy loved them all and smiled up at her.
Yes, ma'am. Sorry to bother you. I feel like a wuss.
Oh, bull crap. Rather a strong imprecation for Mrs. Dr. Ryan. Like I said, life isn't a movie, and this isn't the Alamo. I know you're a tough guy, Pat, and so does Jack. What about you, Roy?
Pat can work with me any day. Congratulations, buddy, Altman added, turning back from the lead.
Thanks, pal, O'Day told his colleague. Can I tell Jack, or does Andrea want to? Surgeon asked.
I guess you'll have to ask her about that one, ma'am.
Pat O'Day was transformed, enough spring in his step now to make him collide with the ceiling. He was surprised to see that Kathy was heading off to the OBGYN building, but 5 minutes later it was obvious why. This was to be girl-girl bonding time. Even before he could embrace his wife, Kathy was there.
Wonderful news. I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, well, I suppose the Bureau is good for something after all, Andrea joked. Then the bear with the Zapata mustache lifted her off the floor with a hug and a kiss.
This calls for a small celebration, the inspector observed.
Join us for dinner tonight at the house? Surgeon asked.
We can't, Andrea replied.
Says who? Kathy demanded.
And Andrea had to bow to the situation.
Well, maybe, if the president says it's okay.
I say it's okay, girl, and there are times when Jack doesn't count, Dr. Ryan told them.
Well, yes, then, I guess.
7:30, surgeon told them. Dress is casual.
It was a shame they were no longer regular people. This would have been a good chance for Jack to do steaks on the grill, something he remained very good at, and she hadn't made her spinach salad in months.
Damn the presidency, anyway.
And, Andrea, you are allowed 2 drinks tonight to celebrate. After that, 1 or 2 a week.
Mrs. O'Day nodded.
Dr. North told me.
Madge is a real stickler on the alcohol issue.
Kathy wasn't sure about the data on that, but then she wasn't an OBGYN, and she'd followed Dr. North's rules with Kyle and Katie. You just didn't fool around when you were pregnant. Life was too precious to risk.
Chapter 38 Developments. It's all handled electronically. Once a country's treasury was in its collection of gold bricks, which were kept in a secure, well-guarded place, or else traveled in a crate with the chief of state wherever he went. In the 19th century, paper currency had gained wide acceptance. At first, it had to be redeemable for gold or silver, something whose weight told you its worth. But gradually, this too was discarded, because precious metals were just too damned heavy to lug around. But soon enough, even paper currency became too bulky to drag about as well. For ordinary citizens, the next step was plastic cards with magnetic strips on the back, which moved your theoretical currency from your account to someone else's when you made a purchase. For major corporations and nations, it meant something even more theoretical. It became an electronic expression.
A nation determined the value of its currency by estimating what quantity of goods and services its citizens generated with their daily toil. And that became the volume of its monetary wealth, which was generally agreed upon by the other nations and citizens of the world. Thus it could be traded across national boundaries by fiber optic or copper cables, or even by satellite transmissions. And so billions of dollars, pounds, yen, or the new euros moved from place to place via simple keystrokes. It was a lot easier and faster than shipping gold bricks. But for all the convenience, the system that determined a person's or a nation's wealth was no less rigid. And at certain central banks of the world, a country's net collection of those monetary units was calculated down to a fraction of a percentage point. There was some leeway built into the system, to account for trades in process and so forth, but that leeway was also closely calculated electronically. What resulted was no different in its effect from the numbering of the bricks of King Croesus of Lydia. In fact, if anything, the new system that depended on the movement of electrons or photons from one computer to another was even more exact, and even less forgiving. Once upon a time, one could paint lead bricks yellow and so fool a casual inspector. But lying to a computerized accounting system required a lot more than that. In China, the lying was handled by the Ministry of Finance. A bastard orphan child in a Marxist country peopled by bureaucrats who struggled on a daily basis to do all manner of impossible things. The first and easiest impossibility, because it had to be done, was for its senior members to cast aside everything they'd learned in their universities and Communist Party meetings. To operate in the world financial system, they had to understand and play by, and within, the world monetary rules, instead of the Holy Writ of Karl Marx. The Ministry of Finance, therefore, was placed in the unenviable position of having to explain to the communist clergy that their God was a false one, that their perfect theoretical model just didn't play in the real world, and that therefore they had to bend to a reality which they had rejected. The bureaucrats in the ministry were, for the most part, observers, rather like children playing a computer game that they didn't believe in but enjoyed anyway. Some of the bureaucrats were actually quite clever, and played the game well, sometimes even making a profit on their trades and transactions. Those who did so won promotions and status within the ministry. Some even drove their own automobiles to work, and were befriended by the new class of local industrialists who had shed their ideological straitjackets and operated as capitalists within a communist society. That brought wealth into their nation, and earned the tepid gratitude, if not the respect, of their political masters, rather as a good sheepdog might. This crop of industrialists worked closely with the Ministry of Finance, and along the way influenced the bureaucracy that managed the income that they brought into their country. One result of all this activity was that the Ministry of Finance was surely, and not so slowly, drifting away from the true faith of Marxism into the shadowy in-between world of socialist capitalism, a world with no real name or identity. In fact, every Minister of Finance had drifted away from Marxism to some greater or lesser extent, whatever his previous religious fervor, because one by one they had all seen that their country needed to play on this particular international playground. And to do that had to play by the rules. And, oh, by the way, this game was bringing prosperity to the People's Republic in a way that 50 years of Marx and Mao had singularly failed to do. As a direct result of this inexorable process, the Minister of Finance was a candidate, not a full member of the Politburo. He had a voice at the table, but not a vote. And his words were judged by those who had never really troubled themselves to understand his words or the world in which he operated. This minister was surnamed Qian, which appropriately meant coins or money, and he'd been in the job for 6 years. His background was in engineering. He'd built railroads in the northeastern part of his country for 20 years, and done so well enough to merit a change in posting. He'd actually handled his ministerial job quite well, the international community judged, But Chiankun was often the one who had to explain to the Politburo that the Politburo couldn't do everything it wanted to do, which meant he was often about as welcome in the room as a plague rat. This would be one more such day, he feared, sitting in the back of his ministerial car on the way to the morning meeting. 11 hours away, on Park Avenue in New York, another meeting was underway. Butterfly was the name of a burgeoning chain of clothing stores which marketed to prosperous American women. It had combined new microfiber textiles with a brilliant young designer from Florence, Italy, into fully a 6% share of its market, and in America that was big money indeed. Except for one thing. Its textiles were all made in the People's Republic, at a factory just outside the great port city of Shanghai, and then cut and sewn into clothing at yet another plant in the nearby city of Yangcheng. The chairman of Butterfly was just 32, and after 10 years of hustling, he figured he was about to cash in on a dream he'd had from all the way back in Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn. He'd spent nearly every day since graduating Pratt Institute conceiving and building up his business. And now it was his time. It was time to buy that G so that he could fly off to Paris on a whim, get that house in the hills of Tuscany, and another in Aspen, and really live in the manner he'd earned. Except for that one little thing. His flagship store at Park and 50th today had experienced something as unthinkable as the arrival of men from Mars. People had demonstrated there. People wearing Versace clothing had shown up with cardboard placards stapled to wooden sticks, proclaiming their opposition to trade with barbarians and condemning Butterfly for doing business with such a country. Someone had even shown up with an image of the Chinese flag with a swastika on it. And if there was anything you didn't want associated with your business in New York, it was Hitler's odious logo. "We've got to move fast on this," the corporate counsel said. He was Jewish and smart, and had steered Butterfly through more than one minefield to bring it to the brink of ultimate success. "This could kill us." He wasn't kidding, and the rest of the board knew it. Exactly 4 customers had gone past the protesters into the store today, and one of them had been returning something which, she said, she no longer wanted in her closet. "What's our exposure?" the founder and CEO asked. "In real terms?" the head of accounting asked. "Oh, potentially 400. By which he meant $400 million. "It could wipe us out in, 12 weeks. Wipe us out was not what the CEO wanted to hear. To bring a line of clothing this far was about as easy as swimming the Atlantic Ocean during the annual shark convention. This was his moment, but he found himself standing in yet another minefield, one for which he'd had no warning at all. "Okay," he responded as coolly as the acid in his stomach allowed. "What can we do about it?" "We can walk on our contracts," the attorney advised. "Is that legal?" "Legal enough." By which he meant that the downside exposure of shorting the Chinese manufacturers was less onerous than having a shop full of products that no person would buy. "Alternatives?" "The ties," production said. "There's a place outside Bangkok that would love to take up the slack. They called us today, in fact." "Cost?" "Less than 4% difference. 3.63 to be exact, and they will be off schedule by, maybe 4 weeks max. We have enough stock to keep the stores open through that, no problem," production told the rest of the board with confidence. "How much of that stock is Chinese in origin?" "A lot comes from Taiwan, remember? We can have our people start putting the good guy stickers on them, and we can fudge that some, too." Not all that many customers knew the difference between one Chinese place name and another. A flag was much easier to differentiate. "Also," marketing put in, "we can start an ad campaign tomorrow. Butterfly doesn't do business with dragons." He held up an illustration that showed the corporate logo escaping a dragon's fiery breath. That it looked terminally tacky didn't matter for the moment. They had to take action, and they had to do it fast.
Oh, got a call an hour ago from Frank Meng at Meng, Harrington, and Cicero, production announced. He says he can get some ROC textile houses on the team in a matter of days, and he says they have the flexibility to retool in less than a month. And if we greenlight it, the ROC ambassador will officially put us on their good guy list. In return, we just have to guarantee 5 years' worth of business with the usual escape clauses.
I like it, Legal said.
The ROC ambassador would play fair, and so would his country. They knew when they had the tiger by the balls. We have a motion on the table, the chairman and CEO announced. All in favor? With this vote, Butterfly was the first major American company to walk out on its contracts with the People's Republic. Like the first goose to leave northern Canada in the fall, it announced that a new and chilly season was coming. The only potential problem was legal action from the PRC businesses, but a federal judge would probably understand that a signed contract wasn't quite the same thing as a suicide note, and perhaps even regard the overarching political question sufficient to make the contract itself void. After all, counsel would argue in chambers, and in front of a New York jury if necessary, when you find out you're doing business with Adolf Hitler, you have to take a step back. Opposing counsel would argue back, but he'd know his position was a losing one, and he'd tell his client so before going in. I'll tell our bankers tomorrow. They're not scheduled to cut the money loose for another 36 hours. This meant that $140 million would not be transferred to a Beijing account as scheduled. And now the CEO could contemplate going ahead with his order for the G. The corporate logo of a monarch butterfly leaving its cocoon, he thought, would look just great on the rudder.
We don't know for sure yet, Chian told his colleagues, but I am seriously concerned.
What's the particular problem today? Xu Kunpiao asked.
We have a number of commercial and other contracts coming due in the next 3 weeks. Ordinarily, I would expect them to proceed normally, but our representatives in America have called to warn my office that there might be a problem.
Who are these representatives? Shen Tang asked.
Mainly lawyers whom we employ to manage our business dealings for us. Almost all are American citizens. They are not fools, and their advice is something a wise man attends carefully, Qian said soberly.
Lawyers are the curse of America, Zhang Hansan observed, and all civilized nations.
At least here we decide the law, he didn't have to explain.
Perhaps so, Zhang, but if you do business with America, you need such people, and they are very useful in explaining conditions there. Shooting the messenger may get you more pleasant news, but it won't necessarily be accurate.
Fang nodded and smiled at that. He liked Chan. The man spoke the truth more faithfully than those who were supposed to listen for it. But Fang kept his peace on this. He, too, was concerned with the political developments caused by those two overzealous policemen. But it was too late to discipline them now. Even if Xu suggested it, Zhang and the others would talk him out of it.
Secretary Winston was at home watching a movie on his DVD player. It was easier than going to the movies, and he could do it without four Secret Service agents in attendance. His wife was knitting a ski sweater. She did her important Christmas presents herself, and it was something she could do while watching TV or talking. And it brought the same sort of relaxation to her that sailing his big offshore yacht did for her husband. Winston had a multi-line phone in the family room, and every other room in his Chevy Chase house, and the private line had a different ring so that he knew which one he had to answer himself.
Yeah?
George, it's Mark.
Working late?
No, I'm home. Just got a call from New York. It may have just started.
What's that? Trader asked Telescope.
Butterfly. The ladies' clothing firm?
Oh, yeah, I know the name, Winston assured his aide.